Get a deeper connection with the Cougars of BYU Sports.
God gives us a gift, and we use that gift until he takes it away.
Deep Blue.
Just sitting down afterward and being really tired and thinking like, wow, I just won the U.S. championship.
This is Deep Blue. Here's your host, Jason Shepherd.
Thanks for tuning in for a brand new episode of Deep Blue. This is the show where we get to know the person behind the number that you see on the field or the court. These are the true stories of BYU athletes from their own mouths. My guest today, former Cougar men's basketball player, Mike Hall. Mike, it's good to see you. Thanks for doing this. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it. Thanks.
So now this is gonna date both you and I. I remember watching and covering you as a player, so it certainly makes both of us older than we'd like to admit.
Right.
When you realize how long ago that was. We will certainly get into your playing days coming up throughout this podcast. But since finishing your college career, what has life entailed for Mike Hall?
After BYU, went overseas to Europe for a little bit, played in Turkey, France, Austria, Japan, played in some semi-pro leagues here in the U.S., tried the D-League thing, just a lot of basketball, a lot of life. During those times, you know, I mean, right after BYU, I got married, and then when I was trying to play to have this career, that's when we started having kids. It was kind of a mess, man. I'm not even going to lie.
A lot coming at you at once, right?
It was a lot, but it was fun. It was fun.
But you could never you never got too far away from BYU, and you're here. You've been here for a while.
Yeah.
You work for BYU. So for those that may not know what you're doing now, tell everybody what you do here on campus.
So I'm in the football world now. My official title is Director of Player Development. And essentially, that's, you know, trying to take care of our guys off the field. Essentially, just making sure they have a really good plan B if things don't work out on the field. Trying to give them those tools and, you know, the networking and relationships, or when life happens after football, or every athlete, if you're an athlete, you know this, you have that identity crisis, whether you make $1 million or no money at all, you have an identity crisis because you know, you've been playing this sport forever. And then now, what do I do?
Yeah.
So my big push and my goal is to make sure when they do hit that identity crisis that they're able to say, you know what, I have these tools, I have these resources, I have this relationships, this networking where they feel good about moving on from football.
And that is such an important part that most people just don't think of. And when I say most people, it goes to your point, a lot of times it's the players too, because right. You think this is – look, I'm an athlete. This is what I do. I'm going to do this forever.
Right.
But we know that that's not the case. And really, that part of athletics has really taken a step forward and become much more important in terms of giving all of these athletes the proper tools.
For sure, for sure. And I love it, too. I know, essentially, I'm a basketball guy at heart. But this, I think this job can, I mean, applies to every athlete, whether it's football, basketball, baseball, whatever the sport is. We all have the identity crisis, but we all need that little extra push to have these tools. Why? I tell our players all the time, use your celebrity, right? Use your the people know who you are. So go out and use the fact that people know who you are and create relationships and, you know, and build that networking for when you are done playing your sport that you feel a little bit more comfortable moving on.
So let's get into how a basketball guy ended up on the football team. How did this opportunity present itself?
So my brother-in-law is John Swift. He's the chief of staff. And before when they start creating these jobs, he called me. He said, would you be interested in doing this job? And I was like, yeah, you know, I'm not really a big football guy. And then Kalani got involved, and he was telling me it's not necessarily a football position. It's about our players taking care of our guys and making sure they're okay. And I thought about it for a little bit, and when a job opened and I had more conversations with John and Kalani, I just felt like it was something that I felt like I can be, you know, good at. And then, again, at the end of the day, I just want to help our guys be successful. And whether it's football or basketball, just being kind of a mentor to these guys, it felt like it was something for me.
I don't know if you want to get into any specifics. Certainly, you can take this wherever you want to go. Are there any, I don't know, interesting experiences or impactful experiences in this job that you can recall that have really stood out to you?
You know, I think there's several. I think when guys realize, and it's hard for guys when they have this dream of, you know, being a professional player for any sport, and then they finally realize, like, you know, it may not work out. And when guys start to engage in the process and what I'm trying to do, that is actually pretty rewarding. And then when you see them out, they're working their, you know, their jobs now and they're successful. It's a grind. But to see them kind of start to embrace the life after football and have an understanding and actually use the things and the tools that we provided for them, I think that's probably the most rewarding part. And it's happened to several guys. And this year, we're doing a lot with those guys, and the guys are actually embracing it a lot more, which I love. So it's been really fun.
During your playing days, what would – and maybe BYU had something like this when you mm-hmm. played, but what would this type of opportunity have done for you when you were playing here?
You know, I don't remember us having anything like this. I think I would have been a little bit more prepared, for sure. I know when I was finished playing, I had an identity crisis. And I remember sitting there talking to my wife. I was like, what am I going to do? I have no idea what I'm going to do. I mean, luckily, I was been able to figure that out, but it was hard. And I think, obviously, whether you're a 3.0 student, 4.0 student, and you're an athlete, you want to do this, you know, this athletic side. And when that's taken away from you, you're still like, what am I going to do? So I wish we had something like this when I was playing. Unfortunately, we didn't have anything that goes into as in-depth as what we do now, but it would have changed a lot. I would have been a lot more prepared, that's for sure.
Well, and the emphasis, it goes back to what I was talking about before. This is where one of the biggest advancements has come. Mm-hmm. The emphasis just wasn't on this type of thing back when you played.
Yeah, not at all. I think these days, I think you have more people involved in the community And I mean, for BYU throughout the country, who really, you know, genuinely want to help our guys, and we want to take advantage of that. So we have, and I'm not saying the interest wasn't there when I was playing forever ago, but I think there's more of an emphasis there, and they have people like myself, got Gary Verone with the Build for Life Center, who actually reach out to these people and actually make it a thing and kind of, you know, grab onto it and help our guys to be successful that way.
All right, let's talk about Mike Hall from the beginning. Where was the beginning for you? Where did you grow up?
San Bernardino, California. So that's inland from L.A., from the shore. It's about, I would say an hour drive, but depending on traffic, it can be two or three.
It could be 4 hours.
It can be
at
four
that
hours. So it depends. So I would say it's about 60 miles east of L.A.,
And what type of childhood did you have?
Normal. You know, my childhood was, you hear these things, people say single family homes and broken homes, blah, blah, blah. I never heard that term until I came to BYU. Home was home, whether right. I had just my mom there, my mom and stepdad or dad, it was just home. And I enjoyed my childhood. It was a different upbringing from what, you know, kids here in Utah bring up, but I loved it. And people would say, you know, some negative things about my childhood, but I had a ball, man. It was fun. That's the only thing you know, when you're growing up. So.
And what was your family dynamic? Siblings, like, where do you fall in order?
Youngest of two. So I have one brother, as me and my brother, and then, you know, my mom married my stepdad, mm-hmm. who was around forever. So lived in a small apartment my parents still live in today.
Really?
Yeah, they still live in the same place. But it was fun, man. I can't complain. And when you don't know any different, it's hard to complain, right? Yeah. Like, that's all you know. And I had a great childhood, man. It was fun. There were some challenges, but again, I wouldn't take any of that back.
Was sports always a part of your life?
Oh, 100%. It was in these situations where I'm from, it's either you are an athlete or you're doing things you weren't supposed to do, whether that's anyway, you're doing, you know, things in inner city you can only imagine mm-hmm. what some people were doing. But you're an athlete, or you're doing those other things, and I chose the athlete way. And being an athlete kind of protects you. People know who you are, so you're doing your thing. So it was all athletics for the most part, yeah.
Always basketball, or did you do everything?
I dabbled a little bit in everything, but I just kind of latched on to basketball a little bit more. My friends latched on to basketball a little bit more, and then it became a thing where it was just kind of year-round, and you fall in love with the game, and then it's just kind of who you are and what you do.
Everybody's got their own unique, you know, story on what the recruiting process mm-hmm. was for them. What was it like for you?
It was pretty basic. It's nothing like it is now. Right now, you got social media, so it makes it crazy. But back then, they'll send you letters. You get some coaches coming to your high school to watch you, you know, practice or watch you work out or play pickup and things like that. Most of the schools that recruited me were California schools. Mm-hmm. You know, I had the USC's, and I ended up going to Pepperdine from there. But USC, Pepperdine, and then you had some schools in Nevada and stuff like that. But it was mostly West Coast type schools. I wouldn't say I was the biggest recruit, but I was kind of in that middle pack, probably.
Well, as if anyone needs a reason to want to live in Malibu, as you mentioned, you did pick Pepperdine. So why the Waves?
So Pepperdine, it was a good fit. Our high school center actually ended up going to Pepperdine, so we went there together. And we had a good time. Probably too good of a time. but end up going to Pepperdine, and it actually ended up being what perfect for me. And as far as I thought it was perfect for me. And
yeah.
Then, you know, when you're 18, you're immature, some things just don't work you out. So, yeah. But Pepperdine was good.
What is the experience like? I have been there. Actually went to the campus with women's soccer when BYU mm-hmm. played there a couple seasons ago.
Right.
Obviously in the WCC at the time. So I know what the campus looks like. Mm-hmm. I know that view as you're looking out
right.
over the ocean. What was it like to go to school in an environment like that?
You know, it was actually pretty cool. It's a really expensive school. So you get students not from the West Coast, but from all over. I remember going to school with a lot of kids who parents were like politicians on the East Coast, or parents were celebrities. I know George Foreman, his kids mm-hmm. went there.
Was his son George?
Was
it George?
I think there's seven Georges.
There's like seven Georges,
yeah.
That's right.
But his son went there, and then the girl's sister, you know, mm-hmm. Tia and Tamara, they were students there also.
Really?
So you just had a lot of kids for influential people in the U.S. that went to Pepperdine. I don't know how it is now, but I remember that's what it was. But it was just kind of normal folks. It was fun. They had a good time the weekends. They like to have a good time, just like in school. But it was great school. Academically, it was great, and it was hard. But it was a fun school. I had a good time.
But you ended up deciding to leave.
Yeah.
So what changed? What went into that decision?
So I don't know if I decided necessarily, just to be open and honest. I don't know if I decided to leave. I think I didn't have a choice. I talked about I mentioned the immaturity part.
Right.
Going to school with someone from my high school and kind of being in the area that I'm somewhat familiar with. I don't think I was necessarily mature enough to be in that setting. Just being around friends, having freedom and stuff like that. So I end up, you know, not taking care of the things I need to take care of academically, and end up having to leave Pepperdine, which was awful. And then it just kind of snowballed into some other things that were you probably won't want your own kids going through. But it ultimately became kind of the best thing for me, I think.
Kind of when you look back, it's sort of one of those forks in the road a little bit?
Yeah, it was one of those things, just like it was terrible at the time, but looking back, it's like, yeah, that's definitely what I needed, for sure.
And so tell everybody where you ended up, because you ended up in Utah, but not up in this area.
Yeah, I ended up at Dixie. So the Gib Arnold, the coach at Pepperdine, assistant coach at Pepperdine, he knew the coach at Dixie. Actually, at UVU, he sent me to UVU. And then I end up at Dixie, but the whole thing goes, hey, Mike, go there, play a year, get your grades up. And ultimately I want to end up where he wound up. He ended up at USC.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to, and we both talked, hey, go here for a JUCO for a year, get everything mature. And then you can come back with me. And that's how I ended up at Dixie, just from, Coach Gib Arnold, actually.
So growing up in Southern California, and then going to Malibu, and then you end up at St. George.
Yeah.
Was it culture shock?
It was a culture shock. It was a lot different, not as diverse as I'm used to. So it was interesting. Luckily, we went there. I was there. I went there that summer, and kind of got acclimated and things like that. And the coach we had, Coach Jeff Kidder, man, that dude was mean. He was mean. He didn't have time to mess up. You are going to mature, or you're going to get destroyed. Because he was mean, but he was a great coach, and you had no choice but to mature under playing for Coach Kidder. He was the best coach I ever had. but also the meanest coach. Yeah. But his standards for you and expectation were high, and I think that's what I needed for sure.
Well, and it worked out for you. On the court, you were an All-American in your one season in St. George. Right. So you clearly, you know, continued your progression in basketball. You got your grades up to where, right, you know, everybody was wanting you to get to.
Right.
What did that season mean to you, and what did it do for your game from a confidence standpoint, but just in general?
I think with that season, for sure, I keep saying the word maturity. I think it matured me a lot,
yeah,
that season, because I didn't have a choice. And I think ultimately I know what I wanted. I definitely didn't want to go back to where I grew up, as much as I loved it. But I didn't want to become a statistic, you know, an athlete who had all the chances in the world who just didn't make it. I just didn't want to become that. So being down in St. George and playing for Coach Kidder and at Dixie, I think gave me a chance to really concentrate on kind of really what I really wanted. And that year, I think that year kind of set me up for kind of life now, I think.
And this is where BYU enters the picture. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll get into how Mike came to Provo. We'll get to that when we return on the Deep Blue Podcast on BYU Radio. Welcome back into the Deep Blue Podcast here on BYU Radio. My name is Jason Shepherd, joined by Mike Hall, former BYU basketball player. And Mike, let's get right to how BYU came into your life. You obviously did not end your basketball career at Dixie.
Right.
How did you come to BYU? When did the Cougars enter the picture?
You know, that the year, I had a really good year at Dixie. I was first team junior college All-American, being recruited by a lot of schools. And then Coach Toulson and Coach Rose, they kind of just came into the picture. They recruited me. I remember Coach Toulson being at several games and practices and talking to, you know, the crew, the coaches and things like that. And they were just consistent. And then, you know, you go on these visits after the year is over. And then you have fun on your visits, and obviously they treat you like you're the best thing ever on all these visits. And then I came to BYU. BYU was actually my last visit, and then I just kind of felt like basketball-wise and everything else, it just kind of fit for me. Basketball-wise, I felt like we had a lot of shooters, a lot of good players, but I don't feel like they had a guy that kind of did what I did.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, that would be a good fit. I had a chance to really come and step in and play right away and contribute. Other schools, there's a lot of Mike Halls, man. There's a lot of guys who can jump and big and fast and, you know, they're super athletic. And my thing is, as you probably know, is I just want to dunk the ball all
yep.
the time.
Oh, we're going to get to one of those in a minute. Yeah. Oh, yes.
I just want to dunk the ball all the time. And we here at BYU, we just have a lot of guys who are doing that. So I was like, with my skill set, I feel like this would be probably the best place for me. Outside of the basketball court, there was just, you know, the culture. And then I could just kind of focus on kind of becoming, you know, I keep saying mature, but that's essentially just what it helped me do for sure.
But what would you have told yourself, like back then? The thought, first of all, coming to Utah in general, you end up at Dixie. Would you have ever thought that you would have stayed here? Because I would imagine you probably had some offers back in California, and obviously being from there, that I've got to assume that was at least interesting to you.
Yeah, but I think a part of me is like I was kind of scared to go back home. I didn't want to, like I said, I didn't want to become a statistic. I didn't want to be the guy who left and didn't make it and didn't work out, and then now he's back at home living with his mom. You know the whole story. So I didn't really care where I ended up. I just didn't want to be back in California because I knew it just probably wouldn't be a good fit for me.
What was your thought about BYU being a religious school? I don't know what role faith and God played in your life growing up, but when you're coming to a place like BYU, it's certainly prominent, the religious aspect here at BYU. Was that at all concerning for you at the time?
You know, not really. I went to church a couple times growing up. I didn't necessarily have a religion. I believed in the higher power, but I didn't necessarily have a religion growing up. So I wasn't really scared off by the religion. at all, actually. Like I said, I think culturally, having the honor code, everything, I just felt like it was a good fit for me, what I needed. I was just kind of really, like every most other athletes, just worried about the plan part of it.
Right.
So I'm going to make this work. And it ended up working out, so I'm glad I kind of made the decision to come here.
Well, in that part of it, the basketball, when you look at what your career became here at BYU, can you imagine going anywhere else now that this was the path you took and knowing where it's led you? Can you even imagine going anywhere else?
Not right now. Obviously, I wasn't a member when I went to school here, but now I am. And then obviously that kind of changes everything in your life. And you meet your wife here, and mm-hmm. you have your kids, and your life is set up here. So right now I really can't, just because it's such a big part of my life now. I don't even know what my life would look like, to be honest. I'm actually really nervous to even think about what it would look like. But I feel like I came here for a reason, and it's starting to kind of and I've been seeing why for a long time now.
What did you know about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints at the time?
Not one thing. I didn't even know a whole lot about BYU until they really started recruiting me, to be honest. But I didn't know a whole lot, man. Actually, almost nothing. I didn't really know a lot at all, actually.
So you mentioned a second ago that you came to BYU not as a member of the church. You are now. Mm-hmm. What was your conversion story? Like, how did that take place?
So it was kind of weird. This was when I was playing in Europe. Actually, my senior year, I started taking the discussions mm-hmm. and immediately turned off. I had a group of missionaries. They're great, great guys, but I felt like it was a little fast and a little bit rushed. And I was like, yeah, this isn't for me at all. And then when I was in Europe, I was in France. I remember being in France, and it was raining. I was coming from a practice, and it was raining, and I seen the missionaries actually walking. And I stopped, because I knew what missionaries were. So I stopped, gave them a ride, and then I just kind of started. France was hard for them. I think they were having a hard time mm-hmm. in France. So we just kind of started talking. It was just kind of natural. It wasn't forced. We just started having conversations. And a lot of the conversation wasn't necessarily about the church. It was just, you know, just checking in, just, you know, just being a good neighbor, essentially. Sure. I remember coming back. Actually, let me back up. Sorry. So when I my first country, I was in Turkey. And when I was flying to Turkey, someone stole my laptop and the only thing I had was a Book of Mormon mm-hmm. That my girlfriend, who's my wife now, she gave me. And I didn't have any form of entertainment or anything, so I'm sitting in an apartment in Turkey like, what am I going to do? So I talked to her, and then I started reading the Book of Mormon a little bit, and I remember telling her, I was like, I have no idea what these people are talking about. No idea. You know how sometimes you can get deep into it. It's like, I don't know what they're trying to say here. So I remember she sent me the Book of Mormon, you know, the you give to kids the comics, mm-hmm. their comics.
Yeah.
So I actually started reading the Book of Mormon along with the comics so I could understand what I'm reading, to put a picture with it.
Yeah.
I know that's super elementary, but it worked. And then that's when I went to France after that, and then I ran into the missionaries, so I knew a little bit more. And then I didn't get baptized in France, but I came home, found some more missionaries, and ended up getting baptized after that. So it's a little bit of a process, but I'm glad I did, because here at BYU, I just didn't want to get – I didn't want to do it because everybody else around me was doing it. You know what I mean? I wanted to make sure I was doing it for me, and I'm glad it kind of worked out the way it did. For sure.
Hey, the Lord works in mysterious ways, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Somebody was probably prompted to steal your laptop, and because of that, they had no idea the course they were setting you on,
I
right?
Know. I wish I knew that thing, because I was not happy. I was not happy.
Yeah, in the moment, you were probably not thinking big picture.
No, I probably definitely said some words that I probably shouldn't have said. But I wasn't happy at the time, that's for sure.
Well, let's go back to your playing career at BYU. You played here from 03 to 05. Mm-hmm. How do you look back on your BYU career?
I enjoyed it. I mean, obviously on the court, I wish I did some things differently. I wish I would have had a different mindset. But ultimately, I think it worked out how it was supposed to work out. It was fun. Not my senior year. My senior year was actually terrible. It wasn't as great. But overall, the experience was, it was fun. I had a good time. Got to play in front of great crowds. And, I mean, you know, how these crowds are here. And people in the community love you. And, you know, good thing there wasn't social media then, because I'm sure there were some times where fans probably did not like me because I wasn't playing well. So I'm glad it wasn't as prominent then.
Well, you had already, as you mentioned, at Dixie earned the JUCO All-American honors. Then you come here, and in 2004, you're the Mountain West Conference Defensive Player of the Year.
Yeah.
How validating was that for you? What type of an honor was that for you?
It was great, actually. I feel like I did work hard. That's something, even being first-team junior college All-American and then coming to Dixie, then coming to BYU and getting that award, Defensive Player of the Year, it wasn't necessarily something I was trying to do. And actually, I was kind of shocked when both of them happened, when I got both of them. But I was just kind of playing my game. I always wanted to play hard. And I tell my kids down this, control what you can control. I can control playing hard. And that's just something I always felt like it was just kind of in me. And I think I was a little bit prideful, too. I hated being scored on. And I still, to this day, I do not like being scored on. So I think it just kind of came from that. And I think when you try to control what you can control and you control playing hard, I think those, you know, accolades kind of come with it. So it was good.
How often are you asked about the dunk?
A lot.
For those that don't know, you had a dunk that, according to BYU Sports Nation, by the way, was rated the number one dunk in BYU basketball history. So for those that are not aware of the specific play and dunk we're talking about, tell everybody the situation. And I remember this dunk vividly.
Yeah.
But take us through this play and who you were playing and all that.
So we were playing, it was my junior year, we were playing against Air Force. Air Force, they were a really hard team to beat in the country, not just for us. I mean, I think they ended up winning the league that year. There was a span for like two or three or four years where they were just hard to beat. I think they were ranked at the time, and we were a good team also. And it was a play where, you know, we were going back and forth, and I just got the ball at the top of the key, and their bigger guy was on me, and I saw the opportunity, and just kind of went down the lane, and it just kind of happened. What people don't know, I did not play well that game. I did not play well at all that game. That was a highlight. I actually airballed a free throw that game, like a couple plays before that.
Let me guess. You think you remember that more than you remember the dunk, don't you?
I do.
Yeah, I
do.
Knew it. I knew it.
It wasn't, but the dunk was. I think that dunk kind of helped. It got the crowd going. It got our team going. We ultimately ended up winning that game, but it was a great moment. I remember the crowd too, man. It's when the crowd, the fans, you just kind of sit right across from the bench, and man, it was loud in there. It was crazy, and I remember being interviewed after that game. And I was like, you do realize I only have 3 points. Like, I fouled out. I was like, I didn't do it. But that dunk, and then the next week, you know, they used to have the Sports Center top 10 and all that. So it was on there all week. And so it was a great moment. People remember it.
Oh, yes.
Older people, though. These, not the younger folks.
If you put it on TikTok or someplace, then it'll get a resurgence among the younger folks, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so it's certainly the play that most people are going to remember you by, that saw you and know your career.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your best play, you think? Is it your most memorable play to yourself?
I don't think it's the best one, though.
What do you think?
I don't want to sound like I'm bragging or anything. But I think there's a lot of moments that year, dunks or things like that, where, like, I remember there's a few dunks where they were worse than that one. That game, we just so happened to be on that ESPN Big Monday slot, you mm-hmm. know, and everybody's watching. But I think there are a couple moments where I'm just like, man, I wish that got caught on ESPN because that was a lot better. But unfortunately, it just wasn't the thing. But I had so many moments at BYU playing here, man. It was fun. It was really fun.
When your playing career at BYU is done, you've already referenced that you had an opportunity to play overseas. You played in Turkey. You played in France. Overall, how do you look back on your pro career?
Looking back now, I think it went the way it should have went. I played in Europe, Turkey, France, Austria. Then I ended up going to Japan, played in some leagues here in the U.S. And I would play well, and it was just kind of up and down. And things just weren't working out. Even when I was playing well, it still, for some reason, just wasn't working out. And I was frustrated for myself and my wife, and then we were starting to have kids during that time. Looking back at it now, I can see why. I just don't think it was meant for me to be playing all over the world, and, you know, my wife is here, and we're struggling. I just don't think that was in the cards for me. Just looking back now, how it looks and how it was definitely frustrating, but I can see why that was. I mean, me being the spiritual Mike I am now these days, I can see why it didn't work out for sure.
In the moment, how frustrating is that though? Because you obviously want to, you've loved basketball your entire life, and you want to play as much as you can. How difficult is that when you have to realize that you've got this other part of your life, the family, and these types of responsibilities? How frustrating was that to kind of go back and forth with?
Very frustrating. I talked about having an identity crisis, and I was having that for sure. I didn't know what I was going to do. You know, we were having kids, and obviously, and I'll say this openly, one of my biggest fears is not being able to provide for my family, and I was, you know, how I was providing, it just wasn't working out. So there was definitely some fear attached to that. Definitely some frustration and all that, you know, all those negative feelings you're feeling, and then one of your biggest fears is starting to creep up on you. So it was definitely frustrating and really hard at the time. And there were some good moments. I won't say it was all bad. There was definitely some good moments. And then ultimately we were still able to take care of ourselves, and some things worked out when they needed to work out. But ultimately not having that steady, consistent career was definitely frustrating.
Well, certainly you're uniquely qualified to talk to athletes in the job that you're in now. How much has your own experiences that you've gone through help you in talking with athletes today?
I think it helps, because I think there's extra passion with it. You know, when you live your life a certain way and you go through these same experiences that some of our athletes can potentially go through, I think there's definitely some realness there. And I think the athletes can feel that. I just try to be open and honest and let them know that it's going to suck sometimes. And the first job you get may not be the job you want. But at the end of the day, especially with a lot of our guys are married and some have kids, like it doesn't matter. You got to find a way. And that's not always fun. It's definitely not going to be as fun as playing football. And you don't have that consistent schedule. I mean, when you're playing college athlete, Your day is planned for you. You got your scholarship checks. Everything is planned for you, right? But when real life hits, man, ooh, it is scary and it's frustrating and it's not fun. So being able to lean on my own experiences and talk to these guys about that, and I think they know I want to help them. I think they know that I don't need anything from them. I don't gain anything. Selfishly, I love when it works out, though. I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah.
It is rewarding. But I just love what I do and love trying to help these guys and putting them in positions to be successful off the field. I want them to be successful on the field, but the guys will tell you, I rarely talk about football with our guys. Rarely. It's more of a, how are you doing? How can I help? We got this opportunity. This guy I think would be a good fit for you. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's more of those conversations. We don't talk about football a whole lot in my office.
We've referenced your family a couple of times during the conversation. Five kids, right? Is that right?
So we have four kids, and then we had a baby girl who passed away 2 years ago. So we say five. We have a little angel baby, little girl named JoJo. So
what I have four kids of my own.
Yeah.
It's not something that I have experienced.
Mm-hmm.
How did that experience affect you and you and your wife? How did you guys, if you don't mind me asking,
No.
how did you get through that?
One day at a time, man. She was born. We talked a little bit about this on the Deep Blue episode. She was born with a really rare genetic genetic disease. It's called cat eye syndrome, and mm-hmm. they call it cat eye syndrome because literally, in some cases, your eyes are like cats. Mm-hmm. And crazy thing, she didn't have that. Her eyes are just normal. She just has some other things going on with her body. Some things I still have questions about and don't understand. But going through that is hard. You kind of just take it day by day. She spent a lot of time at primaries and then at Utah Valley Hospital, which I love those people there because they kind of kept her going and kept us going and you know, let us know that we can do this. And we had her home sometimes. So it was interesting, man. Like, it definitely taught our kids a lot about, you know, thinking about other people other than yourselves, because it was a team effort. Taking care of Jordan, we called her JoJo, was not a one-person thing. Mm-hmm. There's no way one person could have did it. So our kids understood that. They had to sacrifice a lot. And they were okay with it because they understood what it was like and still understand what it's like to love someone else, love outside of yourselves, and understand that their mom and dad can't always – their time and attention has to go towards this little – fragile baby. So we learned a lot through that experience. It was hard. It was tiring. But it was definitely, it brought our family closer to understand life and what's important, right? The material things in your life aren't important. Being with your family and loving your family and letting your family know you love them all the time, because you just never know, is really important to our family and what I stress all the time, my wife stresses too. So there's definitely some lessons that was learned through that whole experience, which it was hard, but it was good.
I'm not sure how someone can go through that without having a faith background. Mm-hmm. I just think it would just be so overwhelming. How did your faith help you through that, and how much was your faith and your testimony strengthened?
Well, I mean, I think it kind of gives you perspective having your faith and an understanding of the gospel that you're going to see this little baby again. I see her, my wife and I talk about this all the time. When I see JoJo in my mind, when I do see her again, she'll have a perfect body. She won't have any issues. I picture her just being, you know, a little, you know, 1-year-old baby and just doing baby things, you know. But I think there's an understanding in my mind. I have faith to know that that will happen again. Getting there and there's going to be some time and some separation, but having that faith and understanding that it will happen, just it makes it a lot easier to kind of figure out. And then there's definitely days, you know, because you don't have this physical baby here that you put all your time and effort and love into. But the faith part, it definitely carried our family into making us understand that things are going to be fine and okay. And she's okay. She's not I think I wrote one time, I was very sad that she's gone, but I'm so happy that she didn't have to suffer anymore in that body. So it was just kind of you're so happy, but you're so sad. But I think that's a faith thing more than anything, just to having that understanding. It helps for sure.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for being willing to share that. I know that's a very personal thing for your family. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate you being willing to talk about that and share your experience. Mm-hmm. I've really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you so much. This has been a lot of fun. And I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for coming in and doing this. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, man. It was fun. It was really fun.
Well, that's going to do it. Once again, thanks to my guest, Mike Hall. My name is Jason Shepherd. Josh Bergstrom and Ben Hall produced this episode. Deep Blue's senior producer is Cleon Wall. You can download and subscribe to Deep Blue on all podcast platforms or find all episodes on the BYU Radio app. Deep Blue is a production of BYU Radio.